In 1973, filmmakers Albert and David Maysles visited Gray Gardens, a dilapidated 28-room mansion on Long Island, to shoot a documentary about two eccentric women. Edith Bouvier Beale, or Big Edie, and her daughter, Little Edie Beale, were relatives of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. When the Maysles arrived, the two were living with more than 50 cats in relative squalor, bickering, dancing, and singing.
Did you see the play on Broadway?
No, no, no.
Tea for two, and two for tea, and me for you, and you for me, alone.
The documentary became a cult favorite. And this Tuesday, an off-Broadway musical based on Gray Gardens opens at Playwrights Horizons in New York. A few weeks ago, the show's three creators sat down to talk to us about the production, composer Scott Frankel, lyricist Michael Corey, and Doug Wright, who wrote the book for Gray Gardens. Doug Wright explained how he came to know the two Edies.
I was in a Brooklyn video store, and I remember I was just hungry for something to watch, and I went to the documentary shelf, and there was this odd little woman in an ill-fitting snood staring out at me from a stack of DVDs in a tattered fur coat, standing before what looked like a haunted mansion, almost challenging me to take her home. And so I did, and what followed were 90 of the most hilarious, harrowing, and ultimately touching moments that I'd experienced in recent memory.
Michael Corey.
I had seen the documentary of Gray Gardens and was very intrigued, but I never thought of it as a musical at all until Scott Frankel mentioned it, and I thought it was an insane idea.
Scott Frankel, it was your idea to turn Gray Gardens into a musical?
Guilty as charged.
What on earth possessed you?
I just thought, since both women were so colorful and stage-struck in their way. The mother was a chanteuse in her youth and liked to sing sometimes inappropriate, but parlor songs in her salon. The daughter keeps insisting in the documentary that she wanted to be a great dancer. And I thought that they also had an incredible exhibitionist performing energy to them, not to mention a real affection for American popular music, particularly the standards of the 30s and 40s. And I thought all of those things coupled together, since they were sometimes perhaps frustrated performers, but performers nevertheless, that would lend itself to a musical, and that we could tell the story and we could weave these performing instincts into it that might lend itself naturally.
Physically, a few discrete disparities ought to keep us happy as happy as a clam.
What was the first piece of music you wrote for the show?
Michael and I wrote a song called Two Peas in a Pod. If you know the documentary, the mother listens very intently to Tea for Two. And rather than try to use the existing music from the film, which of course would be a bit of a rights nightmare, but I also thought if we're reinventing it for the stage, we really ought to reinvent it on our own terms, but still have an affectionate wink to the movie. So instead of Tea for Two, we have Two Peas in a Pod.
We're a bowl of peaches and cream. The Dodgers and Brooklyn, a permanent team. India and Gandhi, Dagwood and his Blondie, two peas in a pod.
Michael Corey, you thought that this was an idea from another planet, and yet you acquiesced apparently to Scott's idea and began to write lyrics to his music.
I'm always interested in new ways of telling stories through music, and though I thought it was insane, that was perhaps the greatest draw for me. I didn't have the answers. They didn't really come until after a year of discussion. And what we evolved into was, I think, a very original way of telling a story, where basically you have to view the entire show to know what the story is about. I'm finding that our audiences are on the edge of the seat because they don't know exactly where we're going and how we're going to pull it all together until the last 15 minutes of the show. And that is very gratifying to me.
Doug Wright, let's talk a little bit about the book. The first act is almost an operetta, and the second act is more in the style of the documentary, where Christine Ebersole, as Little Edie, is addressing the audience, and the audience is playing the part of the camera. What was behind the decision to structure Gray Gardens in this different way?
I'd resisted joining the project because I felt like the film was edited in a free associative way and a non-narrative way. And obviously, when you put material on the stage, it needs at least the shape of story. So one day, Michael and Scott were at lunch, and Scott had the inspired idea of splitting the evening into two very autonomous acts, the first set in 1941 when the house was at its heyday, and the second in 1973 when the documentary was filmed. When you watch the film, some of the most striking and stunning moments are when the women pull out scrapbooks of the past and you see them in sepia photographs and you see the house in all of its splendor. And what we've done with the musical is we've plucked all those sepia photos and placed them uniformly in Act One, and all of the grainy color documentary footage becomes Act Two.
I have to get my voice exactly back the way it was when I was 45 years old.
I have to get my voice exactly back the way it was when I made this record. Exactly like it was when I was 45 years old. Face it, kid. Time is a thief. You can't get it back. You can't. Oh, yes, I can. Oh, yes. My voice is beautifully trained. I never strained it.
Act Two, the words are taken directly from the documentary. Were there things that you knew you had to keep? And then how did you decide what to keep and what to give away?
It's a great question. And in fact, I would posit that there are almost as many lines from the film in the first act. You just hear them in a radically different context, so you might not recognize them as the famous bon mots from the movie. The lines we opted to keep from the film weren't because they're beloved chestnuts by the hardcore fans, but because we felt they were the lines that contained the most astute psychological truth about the women themselves.
Everything a person could want, you've got right here.
Yeah, I want freedom.
Well, you can't get it when you're being supported.
You can't.
You can't get any freedom when you're being supported.
Well, I think you're not free when you're not being supported.
Nope, can't.
It's awful both ways, I'm thinking.
I have no complaints. I've got everything a person could want right here.
Oh, you had a rich husband. You should have stayed with him.
I had a perfect marriage. Beautiful children. Terribly successful marriage.
The overarching question that hangs over the documentary is, how did this happen to them? How did this happen to not only American royalty, that they're Bouviers, that they in some ways were our first family, that coupled with these images in the film of the women when they had beauty and youth and promise and their current decrepit surroundings and filth. The challenge of documentary becomes an issue of truth. Whose version of the truth? It becomes very subjective. And I think that sometimes, even as you watch Grey Gardens, the more information you think you have, the less sure you are about exactly what happened.
Michael Corey, in adapting a documentary film to a musical form, where were you looking for inspiration for lyrics for a song to give, for example, Little Edie, something that is better sung than said?
30 years passes between Act One and Act Two, and people change a lot during that. I was interested in planting seeds in Act One of what Little Edie would become and what Edith would become in Act Two, but not showing it to be the same thing 30 years before.
Is the heart of this story their relationship?
The filmmaker Albert Maysles suggested to us that one reason for the movie's enduring popularity above and beyond its camp iconic status is the fact it's a deeply compelling mother-daughter love story. And that's what interested us, because we may not have lives as eccentric as the two Edies, but we all have parents, and we all know what that relationship is. And I think that the remarkable thing about parenting, whether they mean to or not, parents both inflict the lasting wounds and also tenderly and lovingly apply the bandages. And that, at the end, I think, is the story of Grey Gardens.
Doug Wright wrote the book, Michael Corey wrote the lyrics, and Scott Frankel wrote the music for the new musical, Grey Gardens. The show opens Tuesday at Playwrights Horizons in New York. Big Edie was 80 years old when she died in 1977. Little Edie sold the Grey Gardens estate in 1979 and moved to Florida. Before Little Edie died in 2002 at the age of 84, she gave her blessing to the Grey Gardens musical. To see photos and hear a song from the stage production of Grey Gardens, visit our website, npr.org.